We are so lucky to live in Wisconsin, aren't we? We have incredible natural areas. The wildlife that live in this state are really fascinating to see and to learn about. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Really fortunate to have wildlife ecologist Scott Craven come by to share what he's been seeing out in the wild and to help you and I understand what's going on out there. And Scott, good to see you again. Thank you so much.
It's great to be here, Larry.
And there's a lot going on. Now, fall's right around the corner.
Well, it's a great time of year. I mean, it doesn't feel much like fall, not today and certainly not tomorrow when I think it's supposed to be near 90, but it will change. We're in a transition month and fall truly is right around the corner, and that means a lot of activity in the world of wildlife and a lot of opportunity for the people who enjoy that world of wildlife. So, you know, just 2 days ago, the first hunting season's opened up with the early goose season and the experimental teal season and the dove season, and the archery season opens up, I think, a week from Saturday, and there's tremendous interest in that this year with the changes in crossbow legalization. Yeah. So that's a big deal for a lot of people in Wisconsin. Of course, there are more people who don't hunt, and for them or the hunters who are not in the field, we've got all the bird migration. We've got the vanishing act of our reptiles and amphibians as they go either underwater or underground for the winter period. Major weather changes to pay some attention to, and of course, once we have a killing frost or two, then the insects are gone, and of course, all the things that depend on insects, which are many of our birds, clear out too. So some have already started moving, and lots more will over the next month or so. So it's a real transition time, and it seems like summer screamed by, but I always look forward to fall. That'll scream by, and we'll be plunged into the depths of winter again. So here we go.
And hopefully my allergies will go away.
That'll be another plus.
For sure. Well, the hunting outlook, what are the hunting outlooks this year for the various?
Well, let me look at my two pages of notes. I guess the first thing I'd point out is that the relevance here to hunters is obvious, but to non-hunters, there are certainly some interesting points here in that these animals sometimes become more active at the time of year, and as hunters are pursuing them, they move around a little more, so observations change. Migratory birds pack into some refuges like Horican and Marsh and whatnot, so that there's something for everybody here. If folks are really interested in this, then all they really have to do is go to the DNR website and do a search on the 2014 Hunting and Trapping Forecast. It's a 60-plus page document, and it's categorized by waterfowl, fur bearers, deer, bear, upland game, and a couple of other categories. And if folks call with specific questions about individual species, we can certainly look at the numbers. But overall, it's shaping up to be another great year in Wisconsin. Of course, there are, I think, on probably most hunters' minds, the tremendous litany of changes in the deer regulations, which many, you know, 600-plus thousand hunters are going to have to get used to. There's no more emphasis on numbers. You know, you remember a few years ago, not too many years ago, it was always there are X number of deer in the state and the average density is X per square mile of deer range and we're predicting the harvest to be thus and so.
Gone.
So it's been replaced by adjectives like a lot of deer, a few deer, some deer, and so forth. And we'll see how that all plays out. Hopefully it will relieve a little of the contentious nature of deer management. But for most other species, you know, waterfowl populations, especially ducks, again, at record levels. Record numbers of ducks.
Lots of ducks,
lots of deer. Goose numbers are, you know, about the norm. They seem to have stabilized a little bit over recent years. Grouse numbers, of course, they're a popular bird in the North Woods. Central Forest was down with drumming counts. The Northern Forest had a little aberration and ticked upward a couple percentage points, largely because of all the deep snow last winter, which was actually good for the grouse. So it's kind of a mixed bag there, but we're on the decline side of the grouse population. We've talked a lot about the wolf harvest coming up. Bear numbers, record number of permits issued for bear hunters this year. And let's see, I think, yes, it's the bait hunters that get the first shot. It opens today, in fact. and runs through the 9th. And then on September 10th, dogs are also okay at that point. Both groups are out hunting. So that's kind of an interesting thing. And there are some new innovations, too, besides the whole forecast thing that people can look at. There's another really cool for the technical geeks among the hunting community. There's a new program called F-Flight, or F-Flight, however you choose to pronounce it, but the acronym stands for Fields and Forest Lands Interactive Game Bird Hunting Tool. And you can either, there's a mobile app and there's also a computer-based system, but again, go to the DNR website and check this out. It helps you locate the best places to hunt. It helps you locate, for example, young aspen stands in the North Woods, manage sunflower fields for doves in the southern part of the state, pheasant stalking sites. All that information is accessible through the new Flight app. Mm-hmm. And you can actually print maps and look at aerial photographs. It's a pretty cool thing. So anybody, and that's just, it's a great thing for hunters, but it's a pretty cool thing for anybody else too, especially the mapping functions. So overall, the outlooks look pretty darn good, and there are some new innovations and many regulations changes for people to think about and get on top of.
Wildlife ecologist Scott Craven, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in. If you have a question for him about our wildlife or maybe an experience to share, call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post a wildlife photo there. We'd love to see that, or your questions as well. Kathy in Oshkosh has something for us. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thank you for letting me speak.
Sure.
I have a question and a comment. I need to know the number of acres and what percent of the state's land is represented in these wildlife areas, and also the fact that many legislators currently in the state are attempting to push the sale of some of these wilderness areas to lower taxes. I'll listen offline.
Yeah.
Well, Kathy, first of all, that's a very difficult question to answer, and I don't think either Larry or I can give you the actual numbers, and it makes a great deal of difference whether you're talking about, say, public hunting grounds that are held fee title by the state, or whether they're leased lands, which are also attached to these public hunting grounds. And in some cases, federal lands come into play. Nisida National Wildlife Refuge, Horican National Wildlife Refuge, lots of acreage there. Plus, you could construe the county forests and national forests in northern Wisconsin as public lands which are open to hunting. So if you start to throw those things in, it's a sizable chunk of the state.
And our county parks.
Perhaps as much as a third, and that's just kind of baseline guesswork on my part. But if you're talking specifically about those things that are designated as DNR-managed state public hunting grounds, that's a very small percentage of the state, but there are a large number of them scattered all over the state. So all I can say is I think you can get those figures by doing a little searching on the DNR website. I know you can for the public hunting grounds.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you stop into a DNR service center, they have a nice fold-out map of the state, which shows all of the public hunting grounds in terms of where they are in each county. And then you can go to each one, and for each property, there's a map and an acreage total and the whole nine yards. So that's all I can say about that. As far as the sale of lands, yes, I've seen some properties up for sale, but for the most part, those are still, I don't know where that trend will go in the future, but those are areas with difficult access or disjunct from other state parcels or parcels that are deemed, I shouldn't say surplus, I guess, but not central to the mission of some of these wildlife management objectives. So I don't think there's any move afoot to sell off some of the more popular or heavily used properties. I think that would meet with
intense public opposition. Yeah, so, absolutely. Lori in Viroqua has a question for you, Scott. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I'm wondering about wolf society, and since they're such complex social groups, has anyone looked at what happens to the packs after, you know, so many of their members just disappear over a couple of months?
The short answer is yes. I think people said that's certainly a question that's been posed, and I think it's part of the documentation within the state wolf management plan and all of the soul searching that's gone into the discussions following the first two seasons and leading up to this third hunting season coming up. You know, wolf packs are a moving target to a certain extent. All sorts of things befall members of a wolf pack. The packs in Wisconsin are pretty small to begin with. I think the definition is just, the working definition is just two or more animals. But if in fact one member of the alpha pair is removed by hunting, or if that's what you're hunting or trapping, if that's what you're getting at, yeah, there are some changes. But overall, the numbers of wolves are starting to get toward where people are a little more comfortable with them, which is why we're seeing less permits this year. And at least no one has, that I've seen, has suggested that this is a catastrophic realignment of wolf social biology, in part because the majority of the animals taken have been younger animals, which are not central to the pack social mm-hmm. structure. So.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And well, there was a survey on the DNR did, this might be the place to bring it up, about public attitudes toward wolves.
The title, this report was just dated August of 2014 of this year, and it's entitled Public Attitudes Toward Wolves and Wolf Management in Wisconsin. And the authors are three of the DNR's social scientists. It's in excess of 100 pages. The sample size was very large at almost 9,000 state residents. And there are some pretty interesting findings. You know, we've got a lot of the summaries here. As I glanced through it last night in preparation, I think it bears out some of the things that we always speculated on as being, yeah. Well, it makes sense. You know, the folks who are living with these animals in the Northwoods would have different attitudes than the folks living in suburban Madison. And that
in fact is
true.
Is the case. Or Milwaukee and, or any of them.
You know, I thought that a lot of it does make sense, but it's great to have it essentially in print with numbers and percentages to back it up. For example, I think most people would feel that folks living on farms within wolf range, where there have been lots of examples of predation, would be a little uptight about that. And one of the things that they came out, 2 out of 3 people living on farms within wolf range were unwilling to live near wolves, period.
Yeah. Yeah.
Didn't want them around. There was some interesting correlations with whether you were a deer hunter or not. In general, deer hunters living in wolf range wanted fewer wolves in the state. 71% of them wanted fewer wolves. And in their home county, 64%, and were less likely to say they were willing to have wolves living nearby than were non-hunters in the same geographic area.
Yeah.
So there was a strong competitive influence between deer hunters interested in deer and wolves interested in deer. So essentially they're competing for the same resource. And deer hunters' opinions reflected that. What else here? We've got opinions toward wolves were positive. I mean, the good news was, I don't want to make this out to sound negative, that they're way, a lot of people really uptight about this in the state. Opinions toward wolves were positive overall by a slight margin in wolf areas and much higher in non-wolf areas, which we just talked about a little bit. But this report goes through all sorts of categories, breaking down the responses by counties, by regions, by people who define themselves as environmentalists versus non, conservationists versus non, deer hunters versus non, and all of those tables are laid out. So anybody who's interested in this wolf issue, you can call this up online, or you can print it as a PDF, or you can probably get a hard copy of it. There's several nights of good reading there to either bear out what you thought or give you some information that you were hoping to have. So there you have it.
And we're going to take some more calls here. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, visiting with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven and Sharon in Baraboo up next. Sharon, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Last Friday night, for the first time ever in our area, my husband and I heard two wolves howling. Does the DNR want to, if we've never heard it in this area before, do they want it reported or not?
Certainly they do. I would just ask you, Sharon, have you heard wolves before? I mean, are you confident that you could distinguish a coyote or coyote pack howling at each other from a wolf howl?
We have a lot of coyotes over the years.
Okay.
We know what a coyote sounds like, and my husband is a science teacher.
Okay, well, then enough said. But bottom line, anything like this that suggests that any of our more unusual mammals, and wolves still fit into that category, especially in the southern third of the state, they always want to know about this. So it's something you can either report through your local wildlife manager. You could get that as a, you know, an email to the carnivore biologist, David McFarland up in Rhinelander. You could get it to some member of the Wolf Committee. I think the membership's listed on the DNR website. Or you can send it to the home office in Madison. But either way, whatever you choose to do, I think they'd be curious about that in terms of a location and how often you've heard it or whether you've seen anything, whatever the details are surrounding that encounter.
Yep, absolutely. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it, Sharon. Joy in West Bend, you are next. Hi, Joy. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. I have an area close to our home where I used to cross a field, and now it's filling up subdivision, to go to a little strip of woods along a creek. And for several years, I was privileged to hear a wood thrush if I went walking in the evening. I've never, ever seen them, of course, but I recognize the sound from when I lived in Kentucky. So this year, no wood thrush. So I was wondering if you have any information about wood thrush leaving or not coming, you know, through Wisconsin to nest, or do you have any ideas about why this year they wouldn't have come?
Well, first of all, wood thrush, it is a beautiful song.
It does occur
very late in the day, so it's a really cool thing that folks who live near wooded areas, especially, you know, a little further north in the state, tend to get used to and look forward to hearing because it's a beautiful sound. It sounds like you have a woods which is under some pressure and is also small. And, you know, wood thrushes like big woods, and if it was an individual that may have had some history there for a few years, it's possible that that individual bird simply passed on or was the victim of an accident or whatever. So having said that, that there may be local things going on that have resulted in you not hearing the bird, but overall, wood thrush is a neotropical migrant, a bird that heads down into the central tropics for the winter, and a lot of those birds over the years have been the subject of conservation attention because they have been undergoing slow declines. If you want to check out the rate of decline and what some of the predictions are and so forth, there are a couple of cool websites. One is called eBird, just lowercase eBird, and there's a Wisconsin version and a national version, and you can track down a summary of wood thrush population trends on something like that. But there have been some declines, but I'm inclined to think when you mention a small woods, increasing development, and a bird, that there could be many explanations for why you in that individual location are not hearing them that may or may not have anything to do with bigger trends in wood thrush populations.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Vern in Mount Hope, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. While bow hunting, I observed two gray fox hunting as a pair, as a team.
Uh-huh.
They ran along a hillside, one above the other, barking, the other 50 yards downhill and behind. They got to the end of the woods, they dropped downhill and came back in the same manner, the upper one barking, the lower one silent. And I witnessed that lower one scooping up a red fox that ran from the front fox.
scooping up a what?
Red fox?
Red squirrel.
Red squirrel. Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like they've caught on to the tactics Wisconsin deer hunters used for a long time in making a deer drive.
And they found that the one that was barking sounded just like a beagle.
Interesting. Well, they're a very interesting animal to see, and they're a cool animal to have around the state, and that's a pretty interesting observation. But, you know, a lot of the canids in particular are the dog family members, gray fox, red fox, the wolves, and so forth. They're all pretty social and indicate or utilize coordinated hunting behavior. You just got a chance to see it that most people don't.
Yeah, that's really
pretty
cool.
Neat.
Yeah.
Good story.
Thanks, Vern.
Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate the call. Robert and Nina with a question next. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Larry and Scott. I just have a question about the intelligence of having an early teal season. I used to be a duck hunter a long time ago, and even back then people were really dumb about being able to identify the various species of ducks, not being able to tell a teal from a mallard.
Which would be pretty bad, really.
Yeah. I remember one time a guy came up to me and said, just look at this nice mess of bluebills or scaup that I got. And he had a brace of coots.
Oh.
Well, you know, your concern, Robert, was shared by lots of hunters. I mean, the early teal season, when additional opportunities are proposed for hunters, a special season, an early season, a late season, a new bird, whatever, generally there's pretty unified support for that kind of thing. But it's my understanding that the debates over this teal season were pretty contentious, and much of the basis was the proposed or possibility that hunters made a lot of mistakes and other ducks were harvested during this season. For listeners not familiar with this, blue-wing and green-wing teal are a small duck, very fast flyers, very sporting. Their populations have been doing pretty well, and the proposal was to allow Wisconsin hunters, this went on in some other states as well, an experimental short season that just opened this past Monday and closes on the 7th, I believe it is. It was just a seven-day season. And the opportunity was to harvest, I think it was six teal a day, but no other ducks. This is an exclusive of the regular duck hunting season completely. But the key here is that it is viewed as an experiment. And I admit, understandably, the DNR folks and the federal wardens and so forth have been fairly tight-lipped about what their tactics are going to be, but I think there are both volunteers and enforcement people out watching what's going on and attempting to ensure that this illegal killing of other ducks other than teal does not happen, or if it happens, it's, you know, at such a low level that it's tolerable for the teal season. But that will probably be, if it happens, that would be the, I think, the singular thing that would result in this experimental season and maybe not recurring. So your concerns are shared by a lot of other people, but if hunters have taken their time to learn their duck identification, and many are very good at it, and only teal are being taken, then it is another opportunity that the teal population supposedly can sustain. Blue-wing teal, about two-thirds of those in the Wisconsin harvest originate here in Wisconsin. Virtually all the green-wing teal come from further north. So we'll see what happens. It's only for a week. It'll be well analyzed and assessed once it's over. We'll see what happens in the future.
Thank you very much for calling. And if you're hunting teal or ducks of any kind, you need a federal duck stamp. And even if you're not a hunter, I think the purchase of a duck stamp is really
it's a good thing to do.
Yeah,
it's, as a matter of fact, Larry, a couple things on that front. Number one, I agree with you. Buying a $15 duck stamp is about the easiest way for somebody interested in wildlife habitat to get some money into the system for wetland protection and management and conservation. And whether you're a hunter or not, wetlands support lots of other bird life other than ducks and geese. And realistically, ducks and geese are only game birds in the real sense for a very short period in the fall.
Yeah.
And the rest of the year, people are out there looking at broods of ducklings in the spring and summer and enjoying them as essentially non-game during the period when the hunting season's on. There's actually a group moving forward now called the Friends of the Duck Stamp that you can find out about. I think if you Google it, you can get the information to join. And there's a commitment there. They're asking people to pledge to buy not one but two duck stamps per year, and whether you're hunting or not. And just because it's a perfectly streamlined conduit to get some money into conservation. And along that note, to celebrate the 80th anniversary of the duck stamp program, Tim Isley, well-known local outdoor writer.
Had a guest on this show a number of times.
He's a great guy, and he's going to be presenting a program at Horicon National Wildlife Refuge on Saturday, October 18th. He'll be featuring the story of Ding Darling, who was one of the behind the early duck stamp, and presenting a DVD on Darling's life. And Tim also has a PowerPoint presentation on Ding Darling and his involvement with Leopold in Wisconsin, how the duck stamp was started, how it's judged, you know, what picture actually artwork is selected to be on the duck stamp. It's free and open to the public Saturday, October 18th at Horicon. And go buy a duck stamp, for crying out loud.
Yeah. And Tim was, at one point, actually one of the judges for the duck stamp prize.
For the federal. So the guy really for the federal, him. Yep. There's both a state and a federal duck stamp. They're both mandatory if you're hunting waterfowl, but we're talking about the federal one that's been around for a long time right now.
Jim and Westby up next. Hi, Jim. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I just got a side note to what I originally called about, and that's the firsthand experience what you guys were just talking about. I haven't waterfowled hunted for quite some time, and I decided to buy my patron's license this year and went out and got a stamp, and my friend and I just went out Monday down at the Mississippi River, and it was just beautiful just to be out and see the ducks flying and everything. Mm-hmm. And I could tell the difference between the ducks. I'm not, really good at it, but I could tell. And just to be out there was just wonderful. But the main reason I called was as an avid outdoorsman, hunter, fisherman, I buy a license every year. A lot of times I buy everything, and I don't always use everything, but at least I feel like it's going to support a good cause. Wildlife management, and I just want you and your guests to just think about, we've got election coming up in November, and who is going to best represent us as governor, especially hunters' rights in the Second Amendment. So I just want people to think about that when they're making that choice.
All right.
Well said all the way around.
It's worth it you study, you look at the platforms of all of the politicians. And if you're a conservation or wildlife management, wildlife-oriented person, you want to, those are things that, if they're important to you, should be looking at what, regardless, Democrat, Republican, or whatever, what the person's stand is.
I think the League of Conservation Voters, keeps track of that kind of thing and has a website with positions and platforms and whatnot. So that's a good point. And the notion of one of the attractions of hunting, we talk about it a lot, and I think it's difficult for non-hunters to grasp just how pretty it is out there. The hunting part of it is important. That's what gets us out there, but it is just a beautiful time of year to be out. Sunrise on Monday morning when the dove season opened, looking out over the sunflower field was just spectacular.
Spectacular. Dave and Elroy up next. Dave, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just had to call in about something kind of unusual. About a week, I live in central Wisconsin here on 46 acres, about half open and half wooded. And a week ago, a cockatiel showed up at our place. And they are natives of Australia. And this guy is having the time of his life. He doesn't let us get more than about 8-10 feet from him. I imagine he was somebody's pet that got away from somewhere. We've told everybody that we know about this, different organizations. Nobody has reported a lost one. I'm just wondering how long this guy can live here in the fall as it gets colder.
So this is a sulfur crested, the big white one with the yellow top knot kind of thing?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
So there's no question about identification.
No.
That's what it is. Over the years, I had lots of reports when I was working full-time. I remember an African gray parrot that was flying all around Madison and I think was finally captured. And I've seen parakeets and canaries while in the field hunting and that kind of thing. So this is an unusual one. I'm surprised no one's laid claim to it. I think they're fairly expensive to buy. And if someone was attached to it as a pet, I think they'd want it back. Of course, it's also possible one of the darker sides of pet ownership, especially exotics, is when some people get tired of their pet or don't want to feed it anymore. Their solution to the problem is to open the door and say, good luck. And I hope that wasn't the case here. I'm guessing that it's not going to survive our winter weather. And if it doesn't have any migratory tendency, is it hanging out with any kind of native birds or is it just taking care of itself?
We see it on the ground eating seeds with mourning doves. And nobody seems to bother it. I mean, the goldfinches and everything are all around. They all seem to get along good. In the wintertime, we often have a little hawk that comes around here and takes a bird now and then. We don't see him in the summer, but I imagine this thing would be pretty vulnerable to that hawk because he's not really tame and he's not really wild.
Yeah. Well, and he's certainly highly visible. I mean, I imagine with the other birds, he stands out like a sore thumb.
Yeah.
So I think the winter weather is going to be a problem for it. It's possible that it might attach itself to a group of birds, you know, a flock of doves moving south or something else, but that might be a long shot. Has anybody talked about, you know, trying to capture the bird?
Well, some of our friends have said that, but, you know, this guy flies around and he's very, very graceful. He soars around. He has a fun. We've kind of lost interest in trying to capture him, and he doesn't really... I mean, you can see he doesn't really want to be captured. He doesn't come that close.
Well, I understand, but there are all sorts of baited traps and other things that a good bird person could probably catch it if it comes to that. But on the other hand, if you choose to just let things play out, give us a call come winter weather on the show and tell us what happened.
Okay.
We'll see. Good luck.
Good luck with it. Thank you very much for calling. Yeah, it's, I don't hold out a lot of hope, but you never know. Bill in Lawrence, thanks a lot for calling. Your turn. Hi.
Yeah, hi. First, I've always wanted to ask this question of Scott. I know that he grew up in Massachusetts, as did I, and I knew a Scott Craven in Millers Falls, Massachusetts.
Hmm. Well, it wasn't me. I'm actually from New Hampshire, just north of Massachusetts, and a lot of us New Hampshire folks felt about Massachusetts kind of the way a lot of Wisconsin folks feel about Chicago and Illinois. But nevertheless, not the same person. But anyway, fire away with your question.
Okay, we live in Lawrence, which is a developing area, a lot of suburban type development. And we have stream corridors that run through here, including back of my property. And as people move to the area, especially on the weekends and throughout the year, it turns into really like a military zone with the use of illegal fireworks. And, you know, the cats get upset, people's dogs start barking everywhere, and I often wondered if there's any kind of an impact to wildlife. I mean, this happens all winter, all spring, all summer, more in the summer, on the weekends, especially after Packers games and they won. And I just wonder, during critical times of nesting, how birds in particular might react to very loud fireworks.
Well, interesting question, Bill. You know, clearly for a bird or anything, you know, including my black lab, who's terrified by fireworks, just absolutely paralyzes her. There's a differential response. Before we lost our old lab a couple months ago, and the two dogs would be side by side, and one was oblivious to the whole thing, the other one was just mortified. And I expect there's a range of responses within most wildlife, too. There have been lots of studies, particularly in places like national parks and whatnot, trying to explore the effects of overflight by scenic viewing, helicopter tours, by river rafters, hikers, and things like that on wildlife. And I think most of them have suggested that wildlife is, in general, is pretty adaptable. And over time, habituates very quickly to disturbances and essentially comes to grips with a human-dominated landscape. The example I would give you with birds, when I was working many years ago at Horicon National Wildlife Refuge.
That was running through my mind,
and
too.
And it was a case where, you know, the federal biologists and the state biologists trying to control goose depredations on crop fields would deploy literally thousands of propane-powered cannons, gas cannons. You'd see them all over the place up there. And at times, you know, it sounded like a war zone when you were watching birds or whatever, and they'd boom, 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 boom.
These were loud.
And they were very loud. And the response of the aforementioned geese, and it was my job to band and mark and watch these geese. You know, when the first few days that the cannons were deployed, they'd go boom, woo, the geese would fly out of the field. And then after a week or two, the cannon would go boom, and the geese would kind of move toward the other end of the field away from the cannon. And after 3 weeks, you know, they'd sort of pick up their head and look, what the heck was that? And, you know, within a fairly short period of time, they were largely oblivious to the cannons. So that suggests as well that at least those birds and probably most others get used to this. I'm sure they're startled at first, but if it's a relatively regular thing, they have a strong or high capacity to habituate or get used to these kinds of disturbances, probably even better than people do. You know, I know somebody who wants to go to bed at 10 o'clock and the neighbors are using fireworks till midnight, there's probably a lot more agitation factor there than in neighboring owl off in the woodlot wondering what the heck that is.
Yeah, there you go.
I don't know if that answers your question, Bill, but it's the best we can do.
Well, it certainly helps, but the one differential there with the geese would be fireworks are at night, and I'm assuming the cannons were during the day.
They had timers on them. That's probably true, and I suspect there have been various types of scare tactics and what are called pyrotechnics in the trade used to disperse bird roosts. And again, if it's a novel sound or when it first starts, those things can be quite effective. So, yes, there certainly is a scare factor, but whether it disrupts the birds to the point that they're not feeding well or it disrupts a nesting effort or an incubation period, I simply don't know.
Thanks, Bill. Thank you very much for calling. Talking about the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in as we take a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for joining us. And join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Join us by email at talk@WPR.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Had a Facebook question from Jan, very concerned about deer ticks. I read guinea fowl love to eat ticks. Is there some native bird that could be managed to proliferate and put a dent in the population of deer ticks?
Probably not. No, I suspect that most birds foraging around on the ground, if they come across a tick, they're probably going to peck at it and eat it. But populations are not that easy to manipulate, individual populations in a wild setting for a purpose like that. So interesting idea, but probably not practical on a large scale.
Dennis in Green Bay, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Recently in Mariner County, I saw a otter come into our yard, and we're probably 3/4 of a mile from the nearest water. So I was just curious, was this an oddball otter, or will they normally venture that far from water?
Well, they're usually associated with water, but given circumstances where either the young one's driven out of the territory or the home water source dries up or they're striking out to find a mate or whatever, three-quarters of a mile seems entirely reasonable, and I suspect they could be found, first of all, with Wisconsin's climate and the number of streams and lakes and ponds and drainage ditches and everything else, it's not easy to get too many miles from some water,
yeah.
But three-quarters of a mile seems entirely reasonable.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling. And let's turn to Judy in Reedstown next. Hi, Judy.
Hello. Earlier in the show, I heard Scott Craven mention that there are more and more hunting seasons, that the days are being increased, and he sees it as more opportunities for hunting. I'm a small landowner. I have about 180 acres, and I unfortunately see it as more opportunity for trespassing. So my question really is, what is the extension or the university think about the suggestions that the DNR take on more responsibility for controlling trespassing or some of the other abuses of hunting? But trespassing right now is probably the most prevalent thing that bothers you.
Yeah.
You really can't go out in your woods safely with a dog.
Well, yes, that's definitely a problem, Judy, and it's more of a problem in some areas than others. It's more of a problem in areas where land has changed hands and perhaps some individuals had a heritage with hunting a particular piece of property. However, there's pretty good coverage of that topic presented in all hunter education classes in terms of what people have to go through. I mean, I think hunters know the trespass laws, whether they choose to abide by them or not is another matter. But from the landowner's perspective, you need to make sure that your land is adequately posted so that there's, it's pretty obvious where the boundaries are.
Yeah.
You need to work collaboratively with your neighbors. If there's a hunting group on the adjoining property, make sure they understand what your wishes are. In the case of the farm that I hunt deer on, I mean, I'm probably going to go out one of the next couple of evenings and meet with the adjoining property owners just so we know whose position is what. If an animal is being tracked or wounded or something like that, Do you mind if we recover it? Do we mind if they recover it? And all that kind of thing, so that you're on the same page with your neighbors. Your property boundaries are marked. Now, if you live along a road boundary, or you abut public land where there tends to be more activity, then again, the DNR will mark your boundary with little posts or signs that say private lands ahead so that hunters are aware that, hey, there's a boundary here coming up that I need to respect. If any hunter or any other land user shows no respect for your property boundaries, then that becomes a civil matter. And the difficulty, I guess, or one of them, has been that that's generally enforced by the sheriff's office rather than the DNR game wardens. And if there's a move afoot to provide more authority to the game, fish and game wardens or conservation officers to play the role of the local sheriff, I'm not aware of that, although it seems to me I've heard something. Have you heard anything about that, Larry?
No, I haven't.
Well, that's certainly a possibility, so that the conservation officers could also chip in with the enforcement issue. But if you've taken the steps that I mentioned earlier and you still have trespass problems, if you can find some of these people and they're apprehended and prosecuted, the word gets out in the local community pretty quickly.
Yeah, It is frustrating.
And admittedly, for many years, the gun deer season was the time when everybody was out there over Thanksgiving week. And now, as I said, there are all sorts of special seasons, literally from early September now into January. So
yeah.
You're correct in your assessment that there's more time for the hunters to be afield. From the hunter's perspective and the DNR manager's perspective, this is more opportunity. But as you say, it's also more opportunity for conflict.
Thank you, Judy, for calling. Appreciate your call. Tom in Green Bay is our next caller. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Give you a situation about firecrackers and at night. Historically, at Green Bay, they used to have their 4th of July fireworks display and everybody out to the Green Bay Beach area on the lower end of the bay. And they put in a dredge boil island out there, which got occupied by some birds. And so they were shooting firecrackers out, or all of their fireworks display out over this island. And Fish and Wildlife, this was at this time the island was still owned by the Corps of Engineers and not by the county. And Fish and Wildlife and the University of Wisconsin Green Bay, we were doing toxic studies on foresters and common terns out there. The day after the fireworks display, we had stunned birds. We had some dead birds. These were adults. We had nests that were deserted. Complaint was large. Was with the Corps of Engineers, who owned the island and the city, and they stopped doing their firework displays out over Bay Beach, and they moved it to the Ray Nitschke Bridge in downtown Green Bay, and they now have a huge celebration downtown and put the fireworks out over the river.
Well, it's
but nesting birds, fireworks over nesting birds can be very, very bad.
Yeah.
Well, and those kinds of things, a commercial display like that is, you know, yeah, we're talking about some
heavy
pretty
duty,
powerful explosions and concussions and so forth, and that seems like it was ill thought out from the get-go, but it seems like things ended well, at least for that particular site.
Yeah.
So thanks very much for that information. That's firsthand information for the previous caller.
Yeah, appreciate it. And Meredith and Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi there, Dr. Craven and Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I graduated from the UW-Madison Wildlife Department coming up on 3 years ago now, and I'm trying to make my way in the field, wildlife biology, natural resources management. And I'm curious what advice Dr. Craven might have for somebody at my stage getting into my career as a natural resource manager.
There you go.
Wow. Well, I'm a couple years removed now from the advising game in terms of dealing with our students, but I always enjoyed that part of the job greatly. It's frustrating for us who have been in the profession for a long time and are working with young people who really dearly want to break in to come up with the proper strategy or course of action, but there are a few kind of givens in the system. One is the importance of networking and getting to know other professionals so that your name is kind of around, so that when a job pops up or even a volunteer opportunity, people are thinking about you. And the ways to do that include trying to stay active with things that are going on campus where agency speakers may be coming in or there's an opportunity to interact with them, to certainly stay active in the professional societies like the Wildlife Society. We have a big joint meeting with our counterparts in Minnesota coming up in Duluth this February, where there hopefully we'll have 400 people from this area. All sorts of information is exchanged there on professional opportunities, graduate degrees, volunteer programs, and so forth. And on a larger scale, the national organization of the Wildlife Society is meeting the last week in October in Pittsburgh, and there'll be several thousand people there. And again, lots of information changes hands. But from the get-go, it is absolutely important, not only the educational part of it, but the volunteer part, to make sure that whether you're doing this as a hobby or trying to pursue eventually a full-time career-level position, that you get out and volunteer for as much stuff as you can, not only to improve the suite of skills you can offer in your resume, but again, just to meet people who have other contacts. The way the multiplier effects work, you know 10 people and they all know 10 people and then they all know 10 people and all of a sudden you know tens of thousands of people indirectly. And that ultimately helps a lot. I would say that coupled with continuing the professional exposure is about the best advice I can give you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good luck, it's Meredith.
Yeah, that's great advice, actually. I would give the same advice. And And if those are still in school, the other thing that I always talk about with if you've got a child that's in school or at the university or college level, internships are extremely important. It's kind of like I always think of three legs of a stool. One is the internship. One is how you do with your coursework. But then the third one is your organizations that you belong to and your activities. You're active in all three of those areas. You're probably going to eventually have good luck.
Yep.
And thanks again, Meredith. And Richard in Stafford, Stratford, your turn. Hi, Richard.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I've listened for years. It's the first time I've ever called in. A couple of weeks ago, we found a young, I think it's pronounced Misagwa. It's a small-headed rattlesnake in our flower garden. Dog found it.
Mm-hmm.
And we captured it and put it out into the cornfield and then looked it up. And my wife did call into a DNR number to report it. Never have had a response to it. According to the graphics from the DNR, we're beyond the fringe area somewhat. We're between Wausau and Marshfield.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, I know it's a protected animal, and according to the information, it said it should not, the bite and venom should not make an adult person more than sick. But we've also got 60 and 70-pound dogs here, and I'm wondering what the effect might be there and what steps to take and any other information you might have.
Massasaugas.
Oh, boy. Well, Richard, Well, let me answer a couple of the biology questions first.
We only have about 40 seconds.
All right, so it's a very rare snake, a very rare snake, and not that easy to identify. The first issue is, did you happen to take a picture of it or have any documentation so somebody could take a look at it? That's really important. Number two, they aren't as dangerous as a timber rattlesnake, but most they're a lowland swamp-loving animal. The common name is swamp rattler. And most of the interaction, adverse interaction with people is when hunting dogs were bitten. And even that doesn't happen very often. So we're talking about a rare animal. I would, if it were confirmed and it's out of range, then that is something the DNR should be interested in. I'm not sure where you reported it, but it should go to the Natural Heritage Division in the DNR in Madison, and their herpetology people would be very interested in that and trying to verify it as a record.
And thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest today. He'll be with us right up till 12:30. Take a quick look at the news, weather, and then we'll be back with Scott. You stay with us. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are taking a look at the world of wildlife today and what a great world it is for the state of Wisconsin. With our guest, Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. He's been with us for many years. And always fun to have him come by to talk with us about what's going on in that world of wildlife. You can join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. And we have callers online. Certainly, you can join in again. The number 1-800-642-1234. But let's turn to Bill in Madison next. Bill, thank you for calling. Hi.
Thank you for having me. I have three chipmunk questions. First, one sits in the backyard and goes chirp, chirp, chirp. I'm wondering if you had an idea why they do it. The second would be, do they hibernate? And are they likely to nest in automobiles?
Well, let's take those in order. First of all, the chirping. Chipmunks make sounds that are among the most bird-like of any mammal. People hear chipmunks chirping in the woods, and it sounds very much the usual response if I'm on a field trip or tours. What kind of bird is that? And it sounds bird-like, but they're chirping or calling. It's their form of communication as an alarm call and communication with other chipmunks the same way coyotes bark and howl or deer snort and assorted other things. It's what chipmunks do to vocalize. So nothing particularly unusual there. In terms of the hibernation, yes, they'll be down for the winter, and they stash or cache a lot of food, so they're a bit more active than some mammals that are like a ground squirrel that are truly down for the count, but they will be out of sight, out of mind for the winter season. In terms of nesting in a vehicle, not sure what you're driving at there, Bill. It's you know, generally they'll go underground and they'll have a chamber and so forth, but under duress or extraordinary circumstances, I've had people turn up with all sorts of animals in their stored boats, cars. You remember the infamous gopher that ended up in a hay bale from South Dakota that we found out about years ago. So strange things
prairie do dog it was.
Prairie dog, that's right. Strange things do happen, but under normal circumstances, chipmunk's going to be in its burrow underground.
There you go. Thanks, Bill. And Mary in La Crosse, you're next. Hi, Mary.
Hi. My question for Scott is about posting. A little bit ago, you recommended to the lady that she post her property, but I'm remembering several years ago when Dwayne Johnsrud was rep from Crawford County, that area of southwest Wisconsin, and he passed a law that everything was considered no trespassing unless, I can't remember exactly, you didn't have to post for it to be no trespassing. And so I'm wondering if that law has changed. When I lived on my farm that I've been gone from almost 10 years ago, we would put up signs and they would get torn down all the time. And so we appreciated that law, but I wonder if that has changed.
No, as far as I know, the law hasn't changed. Private land is considered posted, and the onus or burden is on the hunter or berry picker or morel hunter or whatever else to know whose land they're on. And it's unless they have stated permission, verbally or written, then they're trespassing. However, I think it only makes common sense, especially if you're in an area where there's a lot of public land, easy access, or a variety of other things, that just to reinforce that behavior in humans, a couple of nice shiny orange signs make it quite clear what the owner's intentions are. And I think that even though it's considered posted, if there's no sign, I think it's more likely in my mind that people may move freely and say, well, gee, I didn't see a sign, I didn't see the fence or whatever, and that's their rather flimsy defense. I think the signs just you are right about the law, but I think the visual effect of the signs promotes the clear intention of the property owner, and that's it.
Thank you.
That's the reason I suggest the posting, and, you know, on our property, I understand
that. You post it, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I know the signs get torn down, blown down, chewed up by gray squirrels and assorted other things, but that just goes with the territory.
Yeah, yeah. And you enforce it if you find someone on the...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, thank you, Mary, for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. We have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly. Brian in Dorchester is up next. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Ernie Dorchester.
Hi.
Yeah, last spring, for a period of time, I heard this, I'm assuming it was maybe a bird call coming from a marshy area near my home, and it sounded, the best I can describe it, as your tongue clicking the roof of your mouth, and I'm wondering if that would be what my dad used to call a slew pump.
Yeah, there's a really weird call. There's a couple of names for it, but I think probably what he was referring to is the call of the American bittern, which sounds like a sump pump operating in your basement. And I've heard a variety of common names for it. Very, very weird bird call that sounds like a water pump operating. But a clicking sound like the roof of your mouth. I mean, I could vibrate the roof of my mouth and get a high-pitched clicking or trill like that, and that's an exact replica of the call of the American toad. And especially from a marshy area, I can't, you know, I didn't hear what you heard, but I think it's just as likely that it was one of our frog calls, frog or toad calls.
Well, it was a single click, like once every 10 seconds or so, just a, you know, one.
Yeah, that kind of clucking or clicking, I can think of a couple of birds that might do something like that. But
turkeys do it, even.
If you can go online or find even, you know, if anybody's still got a record player or tape or whatever else, there are tapes of songs of night birds, songs of marsh birds, things like that that you can probably find online, and just run through a few of the common ones in your area and see if you can match something up.
Yeah, good luck.
Sure.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We had an email from Paul who said, in regard to the reporting of wolves, some, you know, woman said she heard some howling.
Mm-hmm.
If the caller has access to the internet, the best way is to make a report through the Wisconsin Large Mammal Observation Form on the DNR website. You search large animal or large mammal observation at the dnr.wi.gov to get to that form. So that's
okay.
That's where you should go.
And that's for years where they've been recording people who see cougars, moose, wolves, or whatever. And then you know it's in the database.
Jeff in Minocqua, thanks a lot for calling. Hi.
Hey, guys. Just wondering, I was up in Manitowish Waters the other day, and I saw a doe with four fawns and didn't see any other doe around. Was wondering how common that was and if all of those would have been hers or if she had some others.
The first response is it's not common. I mean, that's an outlier in terms of litter size, if you think of that. An adult doe, the typically twins, some triplets, and I think there are records of four, five, or there may even be records of six. But four is out on the fringe of the distribution curve, to be sure. If they all appeared to be about the same size, then they were probably hers. It's also possible, again, if they were of similar size, that either another doe in the kind of matriarchal family group or whatever, if the doe was killed, I suppose it's possible that another doe's fawns may have attached to the one, two, or three that the one doe had. So a couple possibilities, but either way, a doe with four fawns is kind of on the fringe of observations. It is unusual.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Yeah, yep. You bet. Thanks, Jeff. Thanks a lot for calling. And Kelly in Lac des Flambeaux. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a question regarding those chipmunks and their burrowing or hibernating in their burrows. Do they keep their food in there?
Yes.
Because I found a whole bunch of acorns in my garage, in my toolboxes, in my basement, different places, and I thought that was kind of strange. If they burrowed under the ground, why they would leave food in my basement and in my toolboxes?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't necessarily blame the local chipmunks for those food caches. There are other potential culprits that cache, and the biggest one in terms of storing in the corner of my garage, piles of dog kibble, piles of sunflower seeds, piles of whatever happens to be available. And that's the work of my friendly local white-footed mice or deer mice rather than the chipmunks. So there are other animals that will do the same thing, and whether we'll get to it today or not, one of the things I was going to talk about is this is the time to start worrying about your garages, sheds, outbuildings, and so forth, because the invasion of field rodents, particularly the little white-bellied field mice, will start to come. And they'll get in the garage, and they'll work their way into the basement and elsewhere in the house, and they're notorious for caching piles of food. So I'll dump out when it's time to get cold, and I dump out my pair of sorrels that's been sitting in the corner of the garage. Rest assured that one will be filled with corn kernels, another will be filled with sunflower seeds or whatever. And it's more likely that that's the mice than it is the chipmunks.
Well, okay, thank you very much.
Okay. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Andy in Arcadia, hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. I and a friend were at Pikes State Park in Iowa, across from Wyalusing State Park.
Mm-hmm.
And we were above the birds in a viewing area. They were pelicans, and they're going south, and there's about over a flock of 100. And I'm just wondering what type of pelican it is, white wing, black tips, where they nest, where they winter, and when their migration takes place.
Well, what you saw were a big flock of white pelicans. That's the one we have around here. And over the last, it's a relatively recent phenomenon that white pelican nesting colonies in Wisconsin have really been on the increase. So it's quite a common sight now to see them at places like Horicon and the Winnebago system and other areas of large bodies of water. So it was a rarity. Last spring, I saw a big, I was sitting in the living room actually looking out over one of the windows that kind of looks skyward. And what the heck is that big cluster of white birds soaring around up there? And they soared around. We got outside. Up. Oh, big bunch of white pelicans headed north.
Very cool.
They're cool birds to see, and it's becoming a much more common sight in Wisconsin than it was. Why that is, nobody's entirely sure. There were huge colonies of them out in the Dakotas and into the prairie provinces of Canada, and some of those big colonies, and we're talking thousands of birds, for whatever reason just seemed to break up and disappear. A number of years ago, and we may be seeing the spinoff of some of those flocks here. But bottom line is, they're white pelicans. They come and go much the way our sandhill cranes and other large birds do go, and they're becoming a much more common sight.
All right, thanks.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Carol in Oak Creek. Hello.
Hi. Thank you. I have a question regarding a very bold and problematic fox that's in the neighborhood. Usually they're shy creatures, but this one I've had a problem for 2 years and reported it to various agencies because I'll be walking my dog. He'll chase me home. I've tried everything that people have told me, shout, act big, throw something at it, but he's not impressed. He'll just watch and still stalk you all the way home. And I'm there's lots of children in the neighborhood. I've seen them during the day. He's just not afraid of people or my dog. I don't know what to do about it. And
right.
I don't know if he's rabid or
no, probably not. It's possible, but probably not. I mean, here on campus, every campus publication for the last 6 months has had a feature about the campus foxes. And I think they're now estimating that there may be a dozen or 15 of them or more on the UW-Madison campus right here in the middle of Madison.
And see them all the time.
They see them all the time. People are taking pictures of them. They're sitting there and having lunch, and the fox are walking around. And I saw three as I was launching my boat in University Bay the other day. They've become a fixture on campus, and their behavior and tolerance of people is fascinating the whole campus. So this is happening and has gone on for a long time like this. Fox are very adaptable to human activity. In some cases, they've been kind of driven into our suburbs because they don't play well with the coyotes that are a little more in rural areas. So they're around. Fox behavior, like you describe, is pretty commonplace. And to the best of my knowledge, it has not led to the kinds of problems you think about, like them running up and grabbing you by the big toe or something. That does not
chase me home. Yes, chase me.
What's my dog? I wonder if so. The fact that it was running behind you is one thing, but what we can't assess is what its intentions were.
That's true.
And you know, I can imagine that. Hey, you say, "Oh, there's a fox. I'm getting out of here," and you start running. The dog starts running. The fox says, "Hey, this looks like fun," and runs along with you. So we don't.
First, I try scaring him away. You know, I act big. You know,
that's not going to work. That's not going to work. They don't view people as much of a threat if they become used to it. And if somebody's feeding them, then it's even worse. So it's one of the reasons we just don't advise feeding mammals of any kind very often, like you would feed birds. So not knowing its intentions, I can only tell you that it's a common situation. This is a red fox, right? Not a gray fox. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's a common observation, and it has not led, again, as they say, to serious problems. That's not to say that a kitten or a small dog or something, you know, might might be a problem, but
I have a corgi.
Generally people are pretty tolerant of them and fascinated by them as part of the urban wildlife community, and they've not led to big problems.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Carol, for calling. Appreciate it. And we have, what do we got? Susan in Oconomowoc next.
Yes, that looks good.
And hi, Susan.
The kangaroo mouse question looks interesting, too. Anyway, okay. Fire away, Susan.
Okay. I have something I can think is pretty unusual. We have a wild turkey hen that has adopted us as her family. We did not approach her, but she began following us when we were out in the yard. And we had guests over the weekend. There were six of us sitting around the table, and she flew up and sat in the middle of the table. And she appears to be most calm when we're all talking. And us moving around didn't bother her at all. And I just wondered if how common this is and how we discourage her. I'm just a little worried for her.
Well, much like the fox, there's a spectrum of behavioral responses for some of these animals. And there are certain species that are known for occasionally behaving in a bizarrely friendly way toward people. And the most common example are rough grouse.
Grouse.
Where
yeah.
people will, all of a sudden, a grouse will you know, over the people who were mowing their lawn, and
yeah,
as soon as
right
they started
the
tractor, the grouse would fly out of the woods and land on the lawnmower or on the rider's shoulder and ride around the yard with them, or come out and greet people when they came by a certain point or whatever. And I've not really seen a very adequate or satisfying explanation to this behavior, but it does happen. And I've not heard of it happening with a wild turkey, but I'm not terribly surprised either. And, you know, all you can do is enjoy it for what it is, take some really good pictures.
Don't feed it.
Don't feed it. You know, don't try and catch it or bring it inside. You're right that, you know, the fall turkey season, if you live on the edge of town or in the country, fall turkey season, hen turkeys are legal game, and obviously one that's excessively tame is going to be compromised a bit. But there's really little you can do about that. And enjoy it for what it is, unless some sort of a problem starts, and presumably the turkey will get back with members of its own kind. Of course, with turkeys, there's always the possibility that this particular bird somehow had earlier human interaction, that they somebody yeah. found a poult and fed it and took care of it early in its life, that it was in a barnyard situation. I don't know what all the possibilities are, but
yeah.
enjoy it for what it is. Get a bunch of pictures and
let her go. Thanks, Susan. Ellen in Boscobel, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I was just wondering how prevalent kangaroo mice are in southwestern Wisconsin.
Well, there are two so-called jumping mice. A common name for these little guys is kangaroo mice or kangaroo rats, but those animals that really go by that name are southwestern arid land species. So just to be technical, we have two species of jumping mice, the woodland jumping mouse and the meadow jumping mouse. They're, you know, I wouldn't say they were exactly all over the place, but they're not uncommon. It's just that they're so darn fast that yeah. about all anybody ever sees is just a quick something darting out of the trail they're walking on or getting out of the way of the lawnmower, and it's gone. Could be a leopard frog, could be a jumping mouse. So they're pretty little things. They're only the size of a normal house mouse body-wise, but they have an incredibly long tail. And they have really big hind feet, so they do bound and move much like what you think of as a kangaroo mouse. But those are the two species we have.
And
that's what was there something else you wanted to know about them?
Just wondering.
We've lived for 35 years on this land, and we've never seen them before, and suddenly they were there.
Wow. They're much like our other small field rodents. They enjoy good years and bad years. And if you've got them around and you can actually get a hold of one somehow, they really are pretty curious little animals. But people just don't see them very often, even though they're there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Glossy ibis in Wisconsin. Eric, you got?
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. The caller about the cockatiel made me think back to an incident about 5 years ago in northern Sawyer County.
With a glossy ibis? Oh, you know, here we are. We're out of time, unfortunately.
In terms of glossy ibis, I don't know what the records are for Wisconsin, but at least that's a little more plausible than the cockatiel, because it's a native bird here in the continent at least. There are records in the bird books that list unusual species. You could check that out and see how many times they've been seen and where.
Yeah, so on that note, we're out of time. Scott, thank you so much, as always, for coming by and being with us today. We'll look forward to another visit down the road.
It was fun. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And just looking ahead till tomorrow, Michael Perry is going to be joining us, and he's going to be talking about his new book. It's a novel for middle grade readers, and I'm not middle grade anymore, but I'm reading it and enjoying it, and I hope to finish it tonight before he's on tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.